Hello, and welcome to Das Pinke Sofa, a queer German book podcast and book club. This month in English, since we're reading Dinetta's The Black Flamingo, which just dropped in Germany. I'm Kai, and I'm a queer reader and writer and co-founder of this wonderful book club slash podcast. And I'm just going to do a short disclaimer in German before we continue to our German listeners. Herzlich willkommen auch an euch. An all die deutschen Hörerinnen und Follower da draußen. Falls ihr uns auf Instagram folgt, wisst ihr bereits, dass wir im April Der schwarze Flamingo von Dean Etter gelesen haben, das auf Deutsch in der Übersetzung von Ulla Ide Frank erschienen ist beim Katalyst Verlag. Heute ist Dean zu Gast, daher unterhalten wir uns in dieser Folge ausnahmsweise mal auf Englisch. Ich bin Kai und ich freue mich, heute mit euch über Drag, über das Schreiben und viele andere queere Dinge zu sprechen. All right, welcome, Dean. It's so nice to have you here. I always love
Thank you.
seeing your face, which, and yeah, generally talking to you. How are you?
I'm very well, very well. Excited about the German publication of The Black Flamingo and doubly excited to be talking to you because you've been supporting my writing and this book and everything since The Black Flamingo first came out in the UK in 2019. And yeah, it's just really lovely to have had someone that I didn't know before come on the journey and stay on the journey with me because it's just been lovely because it's kind of a crazy world, like publishing, isn't it? And there's so many new people you meet all the time, but it's nice to have some consistent people, which you have become.
That was a very lovely compliment, and I am quite proud of that. But also, it's an easy thing to do for me because I think first time I read your words, just fell in love with them, and have been very happily watching you. I don't know, just publish my books, create my work, and that's very lovely to see when you think, oh, this person does such amazing stuff. I want to see them. I want to see them do more. I want to see them thrive. I want other people to like them too. So it comes very easily to, push you on other people. And that's why I think I've been saying it for years that I really want this book to be out in German. And now it's happened. So,
Yay.
yeah.
Did you do anything behind the scenes to make it happen? I'm always wondering like how this stuff comes about because you don't as an author have much control over it. So you kind of just hope someone in some country like picks it up and puts in the resources to make it happen.
Do you know what? Not that I know of. If anything, it was just me manifesting it, the energy. And maybe your German publisher have heard me speak about it very enthusiastically, but at the end of the day, I'm not sure how they found you. Probably through, the usual channels. And they said, yes, we're gonna do this. So I'm grateful for
Yay.
that.
All right.
Yeah, as we, might have already clarified, you are one of my favorite authors, and this kind of well, love story, if I may call it that, began in Germany's capital, in Berlin. And I was just wondering what took you to Berlin in 2019 before your book came out.
I was invited to do an event at Literature House, and some of my work had been translated into German, some poems from my first collection of poetry, and maybe some others that weren't in that collection as well. But I was asked to go over, and I think the trip was supported by the British Council, who will send British authors around the world, which is really fortunate for me, but that is a thing that happens. And and I was there doing some readings. I also have a friend who lives in Berlin that I know from university, so I was also seeing her and like just having a fabulous time really. And I kind of hadn't been to Berlin before. That was my first time, and I've been back since. But yeah, it was just really cool just to go out and be understood, because to have my work translated and to have someone, read it out for me or with me, felt just really, really fantastic. So that was the first experience I had. And yeah, knowing one friend out there, and then the British Council contacts and the Literature House people, and then meeting people like you and just feeling so warmly welcomed, I was just like, this is really cool. Gotta go back. So yeah, it was just an invite that I just said yes to. And these things come occasionally, and you never know what's going to come of them. Like this coming weekend, I'm going to the Czech Republic because some of my work has been translated. A few of my poems have been translated into Czech. And again, who knows what's going to come of that trip. So I'm just try to be open to these experiences and be really grateful, you know, when people will translate your work, because I can't check if they're good translations. You have to be so trusting. It's such a vulnerable position to put yourself in, but I can tell, you know, the people that I've worked with, I've always had my best interests at heart, and you know, just are passionate about my writing and want to share it with people that speak that and read their language. So I'm just really grateful that people will take the time to do that.
Yeah, it's true. I think I was going to ask you about this, like whether you were involved in the translation process at all, which I'm going to do. But
okay,
before we get there, and before we get to the questions, I would love to do like a quick fire question thing where I ask you 10 questions and I give you two options. And I know we're like, you know, moving past the binary, but I love pushing people on the spot. So you can only pick one.
No, this is good for me, I'm sure, because I tend to give quite long answers to questions. So the fact that I just have to say one thing or the other thing will keep me on track. Might keep the interview exactly under 5 hours long.
Yeah. No, I feel that. But yeah, let's give it a go. All right. First thing I'm going to ask is poetry or prose?
Poetry.
Black or pink?
Black.
Okay. Fiction or nonfiction?
Ooh. Ooh, this is hard. Fiction.
Writing for adults or writing for young adults?
Young adults, because adults read it too.
Writing for young adults or young children?
Ooh. Well, young adults, because young children grow up.
Good answers. London or Glasgow?
London, because I'm here now. Love where you are.
Manchester or Berlin?
Oh, interesting. I don't know, why don't you answer that question?
Because you know, I'm asking places. The questions.
Oh.
Because I'm asking the questions.
Manchester, because it's easier to get to from London.
might not be cheaper to get to, but it might be easier. Yeah. Film or TV shows?
Film. Definitely. It's like a story. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's a sin or queer as folk?
Queer as folk.
And last one, Drag Race UK or Drag Race US?
Canada. Drag Race Canada.
Fine. Okay, I'll let that one slide. That's okay. You can take that one. That's all right.
The less RuPaul, the better.
You know, you're only saying true things. I'm not gonna. Yeah. Right. While we're already talking about Drag Race and queer things, what I also love doing is to just throw it back. Look at April. Look at the queer things we've been up to that have been on our minds. So I was wondering, are there any films you've watched, any shows, any plays or books, where queerness has been, present that you've watched or read.
I've been reading a book called All Boys Aren't Blue by George M. Johnson, which is a YA
I know the one.
memoir, about a black queer writer from America. And he writes really candidly about his childhood and his family and his upbringing and his politics and how it was shaped quite early in his life from his schooling and reactions to homophobia, racism. And he writes interestingly about kind of the limited kind of options presented to boys, and therefore for a while he thought he might be trans, but then he realized it was just that being a boy seems so restricted, and he wasn't trans. He just wanted to be his own kind of boy, and I found that really interesting. I'm reading that book and enjoying it. In my own kind of like personal like life, there's a bookshop near me that also has classes and stuff, and they do a queer yoga class. So I've been going to queer yoga. That's a queer thing I've been doing. And
I love that.
then, yeah, and then what have I been watching? This I've actually been watching a series called The Power on Amazon, which in the most recent episode, because it's about women suddenly getting this power to have electricity running through them, and they can shock men and do these amazing things with this power, but it's causing a whole stir around the world in this kind of like dystopian future time. But then in the most recent episode, so spoiler alert if you're currently watching it too, there's an intersex character, and that was really interesting because then it's like someone who identifies as a man has the same power as the women. This electricity because they were born intersex. So that was really interesting because I don't see intersex representation in TV
No,
shows
you don't.
maybe ever. Like, so that was really cool. That was probably the first time I've seen an intersex person in a mainstream TV show. I don't know anything about the actor, but the character. So that's The Power. That's on Amazon Prime. That was really interesting.
I think when it comes to intersex representation, I think I only remember actually one, and it was like, this typical Sunday night crime film. That's on every Sunday night, and millions of Germans watch. And in one of those episodes, I think the intersex person might have been the murderer. And I'm like, well, that's great. But yeah, I mean, I want queer people of all kinds to, have roles of all kinds, but not just one little pigeonhole of a role. But yeah. What have I been watching or reading? I just started this film called Great Freedom, which is a German, it's a German film that documents, so it's not a documentary, so a proper like motion picture story, but it's based, I think, on a true story of Paragraph 175, which in Germany, was the it persecuted homosexual men, or men who, are having sex with men. And so it's the story of this man who was already in a concentration camp for being gay when the Nazis were in power, and even after the fall of the Nazis, gay men in the German Democratic Republic kept being persecuted with the same laws that the Nazis had brought in, whereas the East Germany, went back to the previous, still homophobic, but not quite as extreme laws. The German Democratic Republic, they kept them. So this is, yeah, we follow a gay man who was already in a concentration camp and who is now in prison again for being gay. And so far, I've not watched the entire thing yet. So far, not much has happened, but it's still really harrowing. Like, just that reality, which really isn't very far away, and which is still present to this day, happens to this day. Might not be happening to us right now, but we know it happens in the world. So seeing it played out like that, that's just dark. I've not finished, but it's told really well so far, so
Yeah,
I can
I've seen this
recommend that.
film. I've seen it, but I won't spoil it for you. But it's a very powerful film. A film I watched recently as well. I don't know if it's an LGBT film, so I want your opinion if you've heard about this film. It's called Close, and it's the one about the two little
I watched it.
boys.
Yes.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so I think the sad thing is it's more about being bullied for being perceived to be gay than it is about
Yeah.
being gay. And so I don't know what category that falls into, if it's an LGBT film or not, but it's a heartbreaking film and it's a beautiful film and it's about friendship more than anything and about grief and feeling guilt. But all the characters are incredibly, rounded. Some of them very frustrating, make you angry and very sad, but there's a lot of love in especially the opening kind of scenes of the film. It's just so idyllic, these kind of young boys who have this beautiful close friendship. And I don't, you know, it's hard to talk about without spoiling it, but this friendship being called into question quite early on when they move into whether middle school or high school, I don't quite remember, but then them just being naturally close, not being okay with some of their peers, and it's just really heartbreaking how that pans out thereafter. And I think, yeah, what an interesting way to show what prejudice can do, because we don't know what those boys would have grown up to be, because unfortunately, one of them doesn't grow up, and it's just a really heartbreaking film.
Yeah.
But yeah, what did you think? How do you interpret what they're trying to say there? Without spoiling it for your listeners, eh?
So I think to me it's clearly a queer film.
Okay.
And even though none of the characters are ever defined or labeled, I think there's a lot of subtext there, but we can only really assume, we don't know. What I think tips it for me and makes it clear for me is that I think the director and writer, he's queer, as far as I'm aware. And I think his previous film was called Girl, was about a trans girl, I think, who wants to be a ballet dancer.
Okay.
And so this is clearly a director slash writer who, always explores queerness in one way or another in his films. And so to me, this is quite clearly a queer film. Also, I guess because the reality of what happens to those boys is a reality that happens to a lot of queer boys. And I think in that sense, it very much does. I think it also, I think queer writers can write books without any obvious explicit queerness in it or without any queer characters in it. But for me, that doesn't make that book any less queer because the person who's written it is a queer person. So there's still an essence there, which I guess is what I think about Close, which I also recommend and loved.
I've thought of two more because last month I went to the BFI Flare Festival here in London, and that's an LGBT film festival. And they had, I think one of them was the European premiere of The Stroll, which is a documentary about black trans women in New York, and a area of New York that's been kind of heavily gentrified, but they were sex workers working in the meatpacking district, and they're talking about their experiences and how many of their contemporaries didn't make it, died for various reasons. And the kind of discrimination they felt, you know, doing sex work during that time, and people trying to clean up the neighborhood and gentrify the area, but that being their only way of like surviving was doing this work. And just the documentary maker wanted to make it because she, you know, had that experience, and she wanted to tell her own story and the story of her, you know, sisters, other Black trans women for the most part that were there. So I'd really recommend that. And then one set in Berlin was Drifter. And I don't know if you heard about Drifter. Yeah. That's kind of about a guy who moves from somewhere else in Germany to Berlin to be with his boyfriend, who quickly breaks up with him. And then he kind of has no reason to be in Berlin. And so he's kind of like drifting from, you know, bed to bed, group of friends to group of friends, trying to figure out who he is and what he's going to be in the sea, where he doesn't really know anyone too well. And it's kind of a meandering film. And there was a Q&A with the writer and the director. And they kind of said they chose to have a passive main character. So a lot happens to him. A lot of people convince him to do things, to try things, whether it's drugs, sex, sex work, and whether it's to change his look. And, you know, it's just really interesting to see a character who kind of just goes along with whatever people suggest. There's a few times he doesn't, and I think that's quite, you know, powerful, because you see him, you know, taking a stand at certain points. But for the most part, he's just kind of like, yeah, go on then, I'll give it a go. Like, and it's just interesting because in storytelling, you know, we're both writers, a passive kind of main character isn't usually prescribed. Like people say you need to have an active character making decisions.
Yeah.
But I actually really loved it because I could relate. Like there's so many times in my queer, you know, like adolescence and 20s where I was just going along with stuff. And to see that depicted, I could highly relate. And it was interesting, my friend who isn't, you know, a man, like was saying, I can't relate to this. I don't understand why he was so passive. And I was like, some of us are like this. Like, I could relate. I could relate for sure. So that's called Drifter. So that one.
It sounds good.
It's in German.
I'm going to watch that.
Yeah.
Yeah. One film that I've seen and that I found sadly quite boring was Ammonite. And that's by the same director who did God's Own Country. It's one of my favorite films ever. And Ammonite is with Saoirse Ronan and I think Kate Winslet. So they're like the love interests. And generally, you know, beautiful could have been an interesting story, but there just wasn't too much to it. And I think there's a lot of films about, a lot of period films about lesbians by the sea. And I think this is not one that's out in that genre. sadly. But yeah, there's a couple of books that I read or dipped into. I think one's called The Future is Non-Binary by Lydia Meyer, which is a German book that's releasing soon, I think either this or next month. And I had an early copy and I started reading. And I think that'll just be a sort of essential, you know, the sort of essential guide or title for non-binary identity, which hasn't really been... well, this is a lie, but which hasn't been discussed in a mainstream sort of with a big publisher in a nonfiction title. Whereas last year, the Booker Prize winner.
Well, I can recommend one, which is Travis Alabanza's None of the Above.
None of the Above,
And they explore their non-binary identity, but they keep it very personal, which I really appreciate. They're like, this isn't a textbook. This isn't a like how-to guide of how to be non-binary, nor is it a guide that's like telling people how to people. It's just like my experience as a Black queer non-binary person, you know, gender non-conforming person. So I kind of appreciate that perspective of someone kind of keeping it personal, because we can't prescribe to other queer people how to be queer or non-binary or whatever it may be, nor can we explain it to straight and cis people. Like I think lived experience doesn't make us like experts in terms of like you know, an academic or a historian might be able to actually give you expert information. I think But I think if you read enough lived experience books, you can build up a picture of what it's like at the moment. But I think, yeah, I'm interested if you found a book that gives a good overview, because that's, yeah, probably not there. So do you feel the book you just talked about does give a good overview of how things are for non-binary people today?
I mean, I think it does. I've not read the entire thing yet, and it is just a German title. So I doubt it'll, I doubt it can be translated as such into English, because being non-binary in German, I think, is a lot tougher than being non-binary in English, because the languages both, you know, do gender in language quite differently when it comes to grammar and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So I think that could actually be pretty for German readers. But I think there's that sort of personal approach to being non-binary. I think there's a lot more of that available in English language. I mean, what we also actually, the same publisher that does your, The Black Flamingo in German, also translated Arlok by Menon's, what is it? Beyond the Binary? No, I forget now. But yeah, so they also translated that one, and which is really lovely, because, you know, there's still very little about that in German out there, whether that be, you know, sort of in the memoir space or in the general fiction space. So that is great. And yeah, the other book that I read, the other book I read is by a writer called Shada Kurt. And she writes, the book is called Hass, so hate, and she writes about hate as a positive source that, you know, a positive source of power that can create change and drive progress. And so she looks at it from the point of view of a marginalized person in a society. Yeah, that's quite cruel and not equal, and looks at how hate can potentially actually affect something good. And that was also quite interesting to read, and I can recommend that to German readers. Not out in English yet. Might be translated, who knows, but definitely an interesting topic. Yeah.
Is that fiction or non-fiction, that one?
That's non-fiction, yeah.
Oh, cool.
It is, but yeah. I think we've talked enough about other people's books. I want to talk about your book again, your books, because you've got a few. But yes, I think we were, before we did a little quick fire thing, you were talking about translations and how you just have to trust the process and the translator, especially when you can't, you know, understand the actual language. But I was wondering, like, have you been in touch generally with some of these translators, or have you collaborated in one way or another? Do people come and say, hey, that might not work in this language, or you know, this cultural understanding? Is there a way to change this?
There's not been much direct contact. I think via my editor, I got one question come through from the Brazilian translator about a dish that is mentioned in The Black Flamingo that they don't have in Brazil. And so, like, there was a very similar Brazilian dish. And so they were like, can I just call it this? Because then people will know what it is and won't have to look up this this meal. And I was like, that sounds fine. And that was it. Everyone else has just kind of gotten on with it. And, you know, I've kind of seen a video of the French translator reading my work, because he's also a spoken word poet. And so they put him on Instagram and various places reading his translation of The Black Flamingo. But I've not seen or spoken to any of the other translators. So far, The Black Flamingo has been translated into Polish, into German, into French, and is being translated into Portuguese for Brazil. And sorry if I've forgotten any, but I hope there's more to come as well. My dream is for it to be translated into Greek, My, you know,
Ooh,
mum's family
yes.
is Greek Cypriot, so that translation I would actually be able to read, which would be amazing to be able to actually read a
Yeah.
translation of your work. Though I don't think I'd make the translation myself, because but I'm pretty sure I could tell if it was good and correct, but I don't think I could do the labor of actually make the translation myself.
It's been a few years since you've written The Black Flamingo, and you've written other books since. So when you look at that first novel, from, where you are now, what are your thoughts and feelings? Is it pride? Would you have done things differently? Did unexpected things come of it?
Yeah, I feel really proud of the Black Flamingo. Sometimes I'll dip into it and kind of open a random page just to appreciate the writing because I do lots of events with it still, and I usually go with the same excerpts. Like I read the same passages whenever I do an event, a school visit, but sometimes I just like to open on a random page just to see the writing, and I'm often surprised. I'm like, oh, I wrote that. That's really good. So, no, I feel really proud of it, and I think it's stood the test of time. I mean, it's not been that long.
Yeah.
4 years, 5 years, but like it's still definitely, a piece of writing that I can stand by and happy that it's in the world and people are. New people are discovering it all the time. And yeah, I think the longevity of it has been really cool. The fact that, a year after or a little while after it came out in the UK, like it was published in America and now it's being published in other countries too, including Germany. So it just feels like it's gonna have a long life, this book, and that makes me feel very happy. Proud. I am proud.
Yeah, and I think I mean, you just mentioned it, but also seeing like these tiny little black flamingo babies in the form of other translations that just, you know, keep on coming. That's probably also really lovely to see, I assume. But yeah, you've written the first novel you've written with the Black Flamingo was a novel in verse, and I often, when I, you know, say, read this book, I like this book, it's good. And they, you know, open it and they're like, oh, but it's written in verse. And they're like, but that's weird. And I'm like, well, you should just read it. But do you feel that verse novels, like, do they, in that sense, experience a sort of like prejudice when it comes to them? Or is it the opposite? Are you like, oh my God, this is, you know, so much shorter and easier to read. What is it with you when you say, oh, it's a verse novel? What's the reaction?
I don't know. I think no novels in verse are easier to read. And I think all the novels in verse I've read have been, easy and usually quick reads. But then don't be fooled by that. Like, go back and read them again. And because the writers put in a lot of work to make it that kind of easy to read. Like, so there'll be. A lot of thought going into how it flows, into those line breaks and just making sure it's easy to follow and it takes you on this journey and really smoothly. But as a writer, like if you go back and look at all those tiny decisions, every line break is a decision and it's interesting to see those decisions and how it might affect meaning. And sometimes there are multiple meanings in the way a sentence is broken into several lines. It means you kind of get these mini units of words together that might mean something different than if you read them straight across as prose. When you see them broken down as poetry, there's other meanings hidden within there, or maybe not hidden, but there for you to kind of enjoy. So I think novels in verse kind of allow for multiple things to be going on, multiple meanings to any given sentence, and
Yeah, and I think it gets straight into the action and the emotion often, which I think I really enjoy about a book. And I'm sure there are prose books that do the same, but I think novels in verse lend themselves to kind of getting straight to the point, getting straight in the action, getting straight to the emotion. And so, yeah, I think the people that love novels in verse really love novels in verse. And I think the people that are coming to them for the first time are always surprised by like what an easy read this is and how enjoyable it was and how much emotional investment they had in what usually is a relatively short book. They might look chunky, but it's because there's so much white space on the page because it's laid out like poetry.
Yeah, it's true. And also, when it comes to the Black Flamingo, you wrote a coming of age story. And when you say you dip into, well, first of all, when you were writing it, but again, it was a while back, so it might be tougher to remember. But also, when you go back to reading it, do you feel transported back to your own sort of teenage years or even preteen years, because the book starts quite young and then actually goes up to university. Are there, yeah, what's that like?
It's lovely. I think Michael has become his own person. I borrowed a lot from my own life and my own teens and childhood, but I had to make some decisions and I chose to make it slightly different to my own life. Which is actually quite fortunate because now I'm writing a memoir about my own life. And so differences will become apparent to people if they read the next book and then, refer back to the Black Flamingo. You'll see what's different from my life to Michael's life. But there are a lot of similarities. So it is an interesting kind of experience to reread it or to dip into it and be transported to these moments. But they're not always my real life moments, but they are, moments I created nonetheless for this book. So I can see them very clearly, but then so could anyone who's read the book and then is reading it again. So I feel like Michael becomes everyone's. Whoever wants to read The Black Flamingo, Michael will become, yours, and you'll be able to, be with him and revisit him anytime. And I think I like that because I knew in writing a novel, you're giving something away. And so I didn't feel ready to give away my own childhood, my own teens. And so I made sure what I put into that book was only what I would be prepared to give away and have people interpret in their own way and maybe interpret it differently to me. Maybe see Michael's experiences differently. I see it as quite an uplifting, fairy tale, happy version of a childhood, but there's still some really dark things in there. And yet, my childhood was darker. So it's kind of like for me, this is kind of like the happiest version of a childhood I could muster, given the real childhood I had, I guess. Like that's kind of how I put it because I feel like one thing I don't really put into the Black Flamingo is like mental health struggles and depression, which I did have in my own teens and 20s, but because I didn't want to go there, I chose not to afflict Michael with depression. And so that was really interesting because, for some LGBT kids, it might have been really helpful for them to see a young boy, deciding to come out and also dealing with depression. But for me, I felt like that was going to be too much to write. So I chose not to. And so that's what I mean when I say like, it's some of my own experience, but not all, because I wanted to make it uplifting. I think we have a lot of queer stories out there that are dealing with the heavier subject matter. And I wanted to make it a bit lighter than it might otherwise have been if I chose to put everything in there that I've experienced.
I remember quite intensely, I think, reading The Black Flamingo for the first time, and pretty much in the beginning, Michael is a very you know, and somehow almost unabashedly, like, at times flamboyant queer boy. He might not, you know that he's that flamboyant and know that he's queer in those terms. But there were moments reading this when I sort of felt this shame, sort of felt my shame and my little, you know, me as a little boy wanting to do girly things or things that weren't typical for boys, wanting to be loud. And I don't know, I wasn't a boy who played with dolls, but just the sort of loud, you know, flamboyance and joy that a young boy has. And I was like, oh God, like, I'm A, still carrying that, and B, I know what it's like to be that, you know, uninhibited boy who's just trying things out for the first time and enjoying it, but then also getting a reaction that tells you, no, you shouldn't enjoy. And that's still very much on my mind. And so, yeah, moving through, I don't know, Michael's life and going to university, he finds drag. And I think for him, that also comes with, you know, a certain freedom and liberation. Yes. So I was also wondering, what was the first time, when was the first time you did drag? What was the experience like? And any tips for, you know, someone who wants to try it out for the first time?
The first time I did drag was when I was 30, and I decided I'd put it off for too long. It was something I'd always been interested in. It was something that I had always been somewhat encouraged towards, because I was a performer when I was young, so I wasn't shy about putting on costumes and doing theatre, but I never played, you know, girl characters or anything like that. But I'd worn makeup for some of the theatre I'd done, and I'd worn costumes, and I could play characters, and I'd performed a lot on stage with my poetry as well, doing spoken words, so I was already confident. But whenever someone wanted to, like, dress me up in drag or put makeup on me, I'd run from it. I would be like, no, that's not me. And secretly, it was something I wanted to try, but it wasn't something I was giving myself permission to do. And then I saw a course, a 10-week course, on a Monday evening, for 10 weeks, called The Art of Drag, which was happening here in London at a place called the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, which is a legendary kind of queer venue. And the person running it was Michael Twaits, and I was familiar with Michael from just performing on kind of the queer scene. And I think Michael had booked me to perform at Pride at the cabaret stage, or was hosting that stage when I performed at Pride London on the cabaret stage. But back then I was doing my poetry. I wasn't doing drag or anything, but I knew the person running the course, is what I'm saying. And so I just emailed and I was like, I've seen your course. Your course looks great. It's a bit expensive. Can I have a discount? And he gave me a discount to do the course, which was really great. And then I started doing the course, and I found a group of people who, some had tried drag themselves at home, some had never done it before, some were performers like me in other areas, and others had never performed before, but just always fancied themselves as a performer. And we all kind of, over 10 weeks, learned from Michael and other guest drag performers, like, how to do drag. So it was a mix of, wow, like... the one thing that it wasn't really was about doing makeup and costume, really. It was more about character, persona, working with an audience, yeah, how to be funny, how to do certain kind of burlesque and cabaret skills, and then just finding out what is the story you want to tell and what is the message you want to put across to your audience. And then put on a costume and then do your makeup. That was kind of like the finishing touches to the actual character work that we did. And so the Black Flamingo kind of came from, you know, being that flamboyant boy and, you know, but not taking it all the way. And so it was just an extension of what I'd always wanted to do. I'd always been outgoing, I'd always been a performer, but I'd never taken it to this extreme of putting on heels and putting on makeup and putting on a wig and a tutu. And so I just did it. And that was kind of like, yeah, the birth of the Black Flamingo, because the Black Flamingo came from that drag alter ego. Before that, I wouldn't have had a novel in verse, like, if I hadn't done the drag, and then kind of like wrote about that experience. But it was kind of symbiotic, because I'd seen a Black Flamingo in Cyprus when I was visiting my family there. And so I had written some poems about the Black Flamingo, but then I'd also signed up to this drag course, and then I decided to become the Black Flamingo. And then the poems then morphed into the novel in verse. So it kind of all fed into each other. The origin is kind of like not one thing. And I think in part I decided to call the character Michael because Michael Twaite's, you know, the person that gave me permission, or the kind of like the kind of skills to go and do drag. So I say that, but Michael is also my middle name. I don't use my middle name very often. Yeah.
And any advice for someone who wants to do it, who wants to do drag but hasn't done it yet?
So if you can't find a course, because yeah, for me, learning from a professional was the best way I could think to do it. But finding some friends to play with, you know, to do makeup together, to watch YouTube videos, to try on costumes and lend each other stuff, to go thrift shopping with and buy, you know, secondhand costumes and or make your own together. And it doesn't have to be neat. It can be messy. It can be random. It should be fun, you know. And again, I think imparting what Michael told me was that, you know, think about the character first and the message and what you want to get across to your audience before, you know, you worry too much about the costume and the makeup. I think those are the finishing touches. Unless that's what's most important to you, if it's just to look beautiful, like, and, you know, put it on Instagram or wherever, that's fine, do that. I can't help with that. I never thought I looked particularly like well put together, but I had a lot of personality to carry me through.
Yeah, there's different ways to do drag, and yeah, if someone, you know, you just have to find your thing. And that as well.
Yeah.
Something else I want to speak about, and I want to hear about from you, is that one of the poems, well, a version of a poem that's featured in The Black Flamingo, and there's different versions, you know, in collections and anthologies that you did. It's being turned into a short film, and the poem/film is called Two Black Boys in Paradise. And there's a stop motion animation production company in Manchester called 1/6 who are working very hard to get this film made. And I know you've visited and seen the set, and you know, you're being shown the progress and what the short clips are like. And so having all this going on, like, what is it like to see your words come to life like that?
It's been a real journey, and with lots of surprises at every turn, really, because, yeah, the Two Black Boys in Paradise, I think there's a line in The Black Flamingo where Michael's imagining one of his crushes and him being in the Garden of Eden together, and he just says, you know, I see us two black boys in paradise. And then later on, you know, The Black Flamingo was published, and then I came back to that phrase, and I wrote this poem, Two Black Boys in Paradise, expanding on that whole idea. And I performed it at an event. And then when I came to put together my poetry collection, I also put it, you know, in that poetry collection. And I've been, I think it was this, yeah, in Berlin, the producer of the film saw me performing this poem, Two Black Boys in Paradise. And then, yeah, said, could I, you know, talk to you about making something out of this? And I've had stuff made of my poems before, and sometimes it's great and sometimes it's okay. And like, and so I just had no idea what to expect. But then, you know, the next step was like, oh, we're applying for funding with it. And I was like, oh, this is, you're not just gonna like just do it on your computer. Like, what kind of, like, I just didn't know the scale of what was being done, you know. And so when funding came through, and a whole team of people were being hired and like training opportunities for people wanting to learn about filmmaking, you know, was being put into the whole production, and you know, it just became much bigger than I expected. And I was just like, wow, this is really serious. And so, yeah, seeing the passion and the kind of the creativity of all the different people working on the film, from the producer to the director to the puppet makers to the everyone, like, it's just been really mind-blowing to see this many people, you know, working on something that came from my head and now is being transformed through many other people's kind of creativity. So yeah, it's been really cool. It's been great to visit the studio and see they've got it on two floors and they're shooting some stuff in one kind of area and others in the other. And it's like, it's kind of, it's weird because things are bigger and smaller than you'd imagine. It's really hard to describe what a stop motion animation kind of looks like, because they're puppets and, you know, like, and they, but they look so kind of realistic, and the buildings and the mountains and the, all the different kind of backdrops kind of look slightly, it's bigger than a doll's house, but it's not real life, real scale, but it kind of all just seems small and huge. It's really weird. And I think that's what the experience is like. It's a short film, but it feels like a huge undertaking by everyone involved. And yeah, I think everyone's learning on the job. You know, people come with lots of skills already from different things they've worked on, but they're all still learning lots of new things as they make this film. And I'm learning lots of things, like diplomacy. Because you have to kind of like, as someone who kind of imagined this thing when I wrote it as a poem, when someone's turning it into a script and then turning it into a storyboard and then actually making puppets and then actually filming it, like, things are going to change and you have to be diplomatic about like what you know, you can't imagine it's going to be exactly as it was in your head. And so it's been really interesting to decide what is it that I want to speak up about and what is it that I just want to like see what people do with their own creativity, because they've got skills I don't and they can do things I can't. And so it's fantastic and it's surprising, and yeah, and it's great. It's and it's created jobs. Like, it's nice when you write something and then like it makes work for other people. Like,
yeah. Yeah, so that's true. A lot of work. No, it's a fantastic project and I love everything about it. I'm so excited to eventually see, you know, all of it put together as a film. And I know I'm gonna cry, because I always do when I sort of read it as well. But yeah, so excited for you and for the film. Yeah, it'll be stunning. But while we're talking about drag and queerness and being an author, I'm really curious to know, have you been affected at all by book bans, or just generally sort of the right-wing backlash that queer people, queer artists these days, you know, who are open and out there, that they face these days. Have you experienced any of that?
Yes and no. I think the majority of it at the moment, as far as I can tell, is happening in America, you know, in terms of books being challenged and banned. And so I get told about these book challenges happening with the Black Flamingo, but so far I think when the book is scrutinized by these panels that have to like read the book and look for what the problem might be, they found no problem with the black flamingo. And so I think it's just this strategy that's being used by, you know, people on the right wing to kind of take books off the shelf temporarily whilst they're being investigated if they can't get them off the shelves permanently. Because when my book's been investigated, like experts, you know, teachers, librarians and independent experts will read it and then they'll be like, there's no problems here. This is totally fine for kids. But books are being banned and some books have been banned or hundreds of books, I should say. I don't want to downplay it. So, and what upsets me about the book banning is that it doesn't affect the kids whose parents can afford to buy them books. It's the kids whose, you know, parents and carers can't afford to buy them books and they won't have access to them in their school library or their local library. And so I think that's the heartbreaking thing because, you know, when I was younger, I couldn't afford lots of books. We had some, but I really relied on the library, the school library and the local library. And so knowing that there'll be children that won't have access to these books and who wouldn't necessarily want to, you know, they might just want to read it at school or at the local library. They don't want to bring it into their house, maybe, because they might have homophobic or transphobic family, or they might just not be ready to come out. And so this is kind of the worry and how it's going to affect that generation. Obviously, there's internet access and lots of stuff, you know, might be available for free. Like, I would never encourage someone to get a illegal version of my book, but if my book had been banned in their state and they couldn't get it otherwise, I'd probably say get the PDF if you can. Do you know what I mean? Because I just feel like I wrote because I want young people to have access to this story. I want young people to have access to this story, and you know, I really value libraries and school librarians, and I'm so grateful for all the teachers and librarians that are championing this book around the world now. But yeah, in the States, I do hear what's going on, and sometimes I feel maybe too distant from it to kind of like think about it every day. But I know whenever new kind of challenge or story kind of comes up about what's happening with these books, it is heartbreaking, because then I do pause and think, well, you know, I grew up under Section 28 in the UK when, you know, LGBT books were not allowed in schools. You know, it was a law that meant schools and local authorities weren't allowed to be seen to promote homosexuality, which meant that they couldn't talk about LGBT people, and, you know, they couldn't say it was okay to be gay. And this was a law that was in the UK from 1988 to 2003. And that's the whole time I was at school. And I know I was affected by not having LGBT books in the school library and teachers not being able to talk about being gay in a positive way. You know, so I feel like that is the direction of travel for certain parts of America, and it is really worrying because it did have a damaging effect on my generation here in the UK for sure, when that was a law in this country.
Yeah. And is there something that in all of this, despite all of this, A, gives you hope, and B, keeps you, you know, writing and creating and fighting?
I mean, there's not an alternative, really. Like, I don't really need, I do have hope, but I kind of, there's not one single thing that gives me hope. Like, my hope is like, it's just like, life is beautiful. Like, it to sound like a hippie probably, but like, every day I wake up and I'm just like, happy to be alive. Like, and, you know, I've got amazing family and I've got two young nieces, and I think they give me a lot of joy, and I want to just make this world, you know, as best you know, do the best I can in this world for them as well, you know, but also for me in the here and now today, you know, I just want to make sure I'm putting positive things into the world, even if that's positive things regarding overcoming, you know, difficult times, you know, because I've had some challenges in life that I, you know, I'm writing about more now in my memoir, like, and it's been really helpful to be able to face the dark stuff I kind of maybe avoided writing about in The Black Flamingo, you know, because I wasn't ready to. And I think the hope for me is, you know, that I've survived some of that stuff and that, you know, I'm here, I'm in a loving relationship, I've got amazing friends and family, and I think that's enough. Like, and to be an example to, you know, younger queer people that, you know, even when you face, you know, dark times and difficulties, that that there is a way through it if you can, like, find a support network and find some inner strength and you know, speak up against those that are kind of seeking to bring you down, or, you know, even those that are trying to ignore you and deny your existence, like, just saying, I'm here and I'm not going anywhere. And I think that's why I continue to write, because, you know, I want to be on the record. I want my life to have mattered to, you know, not just the people that knew me personally, but to the people that get to read what I wrote and be inspired by it somehow. That's why I keep writing, I think.
Yeah. So I think summarizing it a little would be A, to make life worth living, not just for others, but also for yourself, and recognize what it is, you know, that makes life worth living. And then just keep doing that.
Yes, you can summarize it, but it's actually everything I just said previously.
Well, luckily we've got it all on record. Luckily we've got it all on record.
Yes.
I very much appreciate that, because, yeah, I think we often in moments like this, I think we try to focus on very big pictures and be like, oh, you know, create change, move forward, change society as a whole. But it's also fine to say, hey, actually, I do this for myself. And yeah, not just obviously, but to recognize, hey, I'm doing this for me. I think that can be powerful. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think with that, unless you want to follow this up with something, I think with that, we might be getting to the end of our episode. Unless there's something else.
No. No, I think, you know, the writing, I think, has to be for me, you know, I get to do all these wonderful outward facing things, you know, because the writing is very inward. It's very like, you know, you're sat at your computer and you might be like going back and forth on email with an editor, but for the most part it's very solitary. And then it's when the book is written, then you get to do events, then you get to do interviews, then you get to go to schools and meet the young people that are reading your books. Then you, you know, get the lovely messages online, or even like, I got a sack of mail in the post that came from a school via my publisher. Like, it's just really amazing to see that. Yeah, I do write it for me and for my younger self. But then at the same time, that is still needed in this world. You know, it's not just my younger self that needs this. It's lots of young people need these kind of stories. So I know by doing it for me, it is going to help others, because, you know, I'm not the only one that needs these kind of affirming Black queer stories, you know?
Yes, very much understand. Also, I think I write for the same reason. To see myself, but also to give others a chance to see themselves. When that happens, that's pretty beautiful and powerful. Yeah. But yeah, I would say we've had a lovely hour together. And hopefully everyone listening also enjoyed it. So I just want to thank you for coming on here, for taking the time out of your day and away from writing to speak to me about all of the things you do and the books you put out into this world. I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Well, thank you for all your support, Kai. And we're talking over each other, I think.
We are. So yeah, the internet is not getting any better. So I would say I'm just gonna say a few last words, and they are: thank you, everyone, for listening. You can find us on Instagram. You can find Dean on Instagram. You can find his books in bookshops in Germany and the UK. So go to Indies, get them from the indie bookshops. Thanks for listening. Also to the German listeners, danke fürs Zuhören. You könnt natürlich auch auf Instagram folgen, genauso wie Dean. Thanks so much, Dean. I had the best time, and I'll see you again very, very soon.
Awesome. Thank you, Kai. Bye, everyone.